Welcome, welcome. Good morning. Good morning, good morning. I am so privileged to be here with you this morning. My name is Aaron, and what we're going to do this morning, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in our journey through the book of 1 Thessalonians and our series titled Unfinished. And for the past 2 weeks, what we've been looking at is what makes the Christian view of sex, what makes the Christian view of love distinct from any other people group on the planet. And someone jokingly said to us after last Sunday, if we've been talking about sex and love, then the logical sequence of events means this week we're going to be talking about rock and roll. First off, I thought it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And secondly, we're not talking about rock and roll at church. But we are going to talk about something this morning that I think is it's buried somewhere in you. It's on your mind. And depending on the season of life that you're in, it probably comes to the forefront of your mind the way that it did when I got some really disappointing, and I'll just put it in the category of bad news, about this time a year ago when my dad called me and he told me that he had cancer. And the only question that I had on my mind in response to that was, it was simple, is this going to kill him? And what are they going to do to prevent it from killing him? And I'll never forget seeing him after he had gone through surgery and all the chemotherapy. And I mean, I've seen my dad tired at times. And in fact, I'm the reason why he's been tired most of the time. At any rate, but this was different. This was markedly different. His eyes were tired. His demeanor was tired. Everything about him was showing signs of weakness. And what was going through my mind is this really is getting the best of him. And what really, really bothered me is when I heard him say what he said to me over lunch. And here's what he said. He said, and he, mind you, he had gone through weeks of chemotherapy and surgery, and he's staring this thing in the face. And he said, this better work, because if it doesn't, I'm not going through that again. And everything about what he was saying is he was talking in terms of defeat. He was going through a situation, and what he was losing sight of was hope. And I don't believe that he was talking like this because he didn't want to live. I think it was more simple than that. I think he was speaking in these terms because he was tired and he was losing sight of hope. And what had happened was the chemo didn't just kill cancer cells. It actually caused him to have an infection. And eventually he ended up going septic. And for about 8 months, he was on every antibiotic that they could write a script for, battling with this infection. And I'll never forget calling him in August of this year just to check in on him. He had just gone to the doctor, and I was trying to get the skinny on what he was going through. And I called him, and he sounded tired, and he sounded bummed out. And I asked him, I was like, well, hey, how'd it go? How'd it go at the doctor's office? And he said, it ain't looking good. He said, they're not going to know anything until 2020. And this had been a pretty long journey in my mind up to this point. And I was like, well, what are they telling you? And he's like, well, they're just saying it ain't looking good. And everything in me is like, well, wait a second. That doesn't even sound like something a doctor would say without chasing it with an explanation. And this fool cut to the worst dad joke he's ever told, and he said, you're right. What I'm not telling you is that I'm done with the treatment, I'm cancer-free, and I'm ready to move on. But one, yeah, amen, right? We can clap for that. But the reason why I tell that story is because during that season, something came to the forefront of my mind that I generally don't think about. And that something is death. And I'm not talking about death in a generic sense. I'm talking about death knocking at the door of someone that I love sense. Death making somebody who I view as strong look really, really weak. But because here's what death does. Death fells the giants of the faith. It fells the giants in our lives, and it takes the people that we love. And so for me, what this wasn't about was how powerful cancer was. What this was about is how powerful death could be. And the reality is this, that whether you're battling cancer and you get over it or not, there's a war that we're all fighting that one day we fall victim of, and that's the war that we're fighting with death. And death has the power to take everything that we love, everyone that we love. Death has the power to enter our reality and interrupt our sense of security and our sense of strength. And the reason why I'm telling this story is because I believe that the season that I was in just highlights a fear that's kind of hidden in every single one of us, and it's the fear of death. And not necessarily what death can do to us personally, but what death is capable of taking away from us. So even if we overcome things like cancer or the character flaw or that financial disaster that you're navigating, it's the war with death that we can't win, because death is the single antagonist that human beings have not figured out how to defeat. And the passage we're going to look at today, I believe that it was written in light of this fear. And I believe that it was written to answer questions about death that you and I have. And there's one specific question that I want us to take a look at this morning. And it's this: how can we face death in a way that doesn't allow it to destroy our hope? And there are three things that I want to show you in the passage that we're going to look at today that I believe will help us answer that question. So if you have your Bible with you, go ahead and turn to 1 Thessalonians. I'm in chapter 4, we're in verse 13. And what we read there is, "Brothers and sisters, we do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him." And so what Paul is really drawing out here is that our view of death can have an impact on the way that we experience life. And he's offering a view of death that will allow us to face it without losing hope, because what he's showing us is that if we're following Jesus, there's something at work in us that is way more powerful than what's happening to us. And that's the first idea that I want to draw out of this text today, that your hope, if you're a follower of Jesus, your hope isn't bound to what happens to you. Your hope is anchored. It's bound to what Jesus has done for you. And Paul's writing to a group of people like us, people who've experienced loss, or people who are experiencing loss. And when we experience loss, we find ourselves walking through like this deep, dark valley of sorrow, of despair, of grief, of regret, of guilt, of pain, of anger, of sadness, of anxiety. It can make us feel numb. It can make us feel lost. It can make us feel empty. All of these things emerge when we're navigating what I'm calling this valley of grief that's sparked by the loss of someone that we love. But keep in mind here, losing someone we love isn't the only thing that can drive us into the valley of grief or into a deep sense of sorrow. The word that Paul uses when he says grieve, and he says do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope, the word that he uses for grieve really can be used to describe anything that would drive us into a deep sense of sorrow. And I would wager that everyone in this room has something. We have something in our life, if it were to happen, it would drive us into a deep valley of grief, a deep sense of sorrow. And when Paul talks about hope, here's what he's talking about. And I think it's important that we understand what he's talking about when he talks about grief and what he talks about hope. When he mentions the word hope and he says, don't grieve as if you don't have any hope, what he's talking about is a life-changing certainty. And it's not a guarantee that we'll be able to control what happens to us, but it is a guarantee that we don't have to be controlled by what happens to us. And again, I think everyone has something that if it were to play out, a diagnosis or a situation or a decision, something in your life that if it were to play out, it would drive you into the valley of grief and cause you to question the very nature of your hope. And here's what grieving without hope means. At least this is what I think it means. Grieving without hope means allowing what happens to you to define who you are. Grieving without hope means allowing what happens to you to define who you are. And I think that some of us are in a season. We're right in the middle of a season that we didn't pray for, we didn't hope for, we didn't ask for, and we didn't expect. And it's driving us deeper and deeper into the valley of grief. And how we respond while we're there is what really matters. And I think that's what Paul's pointing to. It's how you respond when you're driven to sorrow, when you're driven to grief, when you're driven to despair. It matters. Because here's what we run the risk of doing if we don't process our pain appropriately. Eventually, what happens is the valley of grief isn't just a place where we are. The valley of grief begins to define who we are. And we start emotionally attaching ourselves to the pain and the disappointment and the grief and the agony and the anger to the degree that the valley isn't just a season of life, it's beginning to define the very essence of our life. And the more that we base our hope on what happens to us, the more hopeless we become. Grieving without hope means allowing what happens to you to define you. But conversely, grieving with hope, here's what that means. It means that you're not allowing what happens to you to define who you are. To grieve with hope, and this is what Paul's trying to show us here, is to grieve with the confident expectation that because of what Jesus has done for us, nothing that happens to us leads to death, because death no longer has the final word. Jesus does. And there's a powerful picture of this. I believe there's a real powerful picture of what it looks like to be in the valley of grief and how to process your pain appropriately and how to really lean into what Jesus has done for us as a means of navigating those times of deep sorrow and despair. And it's found in Luke chapter 23. And at this point in Jesus' story, things had spun literally out of control. And there we have Jesus, who's been trapped, he's been placed on trial, and he's been sentenced to death, and he's been led away to be executed with two criminals. He's got one to his left and one to his right, and both of these criminals find themselves smack dab in the middle of the same situation, and what's happening to them is really hopeless humiliation. Their lives had spun completely out of control. There's no second chance. There's no going back. There's no more excuses, no more time to turn things around. They're stuck in the same situation, but the way that they respond is markedly different one from the other. And so one of the criminals in this circumstance, and he's 12 feet away from Jesus, he's hanging on a cross, he's paying the penalty for the mistakes that he's made in his life, and he's angry and he's upset and he's stuck. And here's what he says to Jesus. He starts yelling at Jesus and he says, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." And this is really, really hard for me to admit, and it might be hard for you to admit as well, but sometimes don't we get in situations where we feel stuck, and maybe it's because of something we've done, or maybe it's because of something someone else has done, or maybe it's because we were expecting God to do something that he just has yet to do or hasn't done, and we stop believing and we start blaming. And we're saying things like, "Jesus, if you really could see where I'm at in life, you'd do something about it. Jesus, if you really loved me, you would. Jesus, if you really had all the power in your hands, you would. Jesus, if you really cared, you would." And the only reason we get into this pit of despair and we start talking like this is because we feel stuck. And what's happening to us and around us has such a hold on us, we lose sight of hope. But we don't have to grieve without hope. We don't have to be defined by what's happening to us. Because here's what the other criminal does in this situation. He interrupts the insult, and here's what he says. He says, "Don't you even fear God? Since you were undergoing the same punishment, we are punished justly because we're getting back what we deserve for the things we did. But this man, Jesus, has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And when he says, "Jesus, remember me," this isn't a, "If you get me out of this, Jesus, I'll turn things around. I'll stop being a criminal and I'll start being a believer and I'll start following and I'll start obeying and I'll start trusting." This man has absolutely nothing to offer. He's coming to Jesus just as he is. All the pain, all the regret, all the shame, all the guilt. And by his admission, he's getting exactly the death sentence that he deserved. And what he's not doing is he's not asking Jesus to stop what's happening to him. What he's doing is he's asking Jesus to stop allowing what's happening to him to define who he is. Look, the thief's circumstances don't change in this story. What changes is the power of the thief's circumstances over the thief's life. And all it takes is a word from Jesus. All it takes is a word. And here's what Jesus says. He says, today you will be with me in paradise. And what that means is, despite where you're at in life, and despite how you got there, what's clear is that you can approach Jesus with every bit of grief, every bit of loss, every bit of pain, every bit of guilt, every bit of shame, every single mistake, every ounce of insecurity. And what he'll do is he won't necessarily stop what's happening to you from happening, but he will stop allowing what's happening to you to define who you are, and he'll give you a hope that will allow you to face what feels like a death sentence without fear. Because our hope isn't bound to what happens to us. Our hope is bound to what Jesus has done for us. Pick up with me in verse 15. And there we read that according to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So in verses 13 and 14, here's what Paul was doing. He was tying our hope to what Jesus has done for us. But in these verses, what he's doing is he's tying our hope to who Jesus is. And what he's doing is he's telling us the next idea that I want to share with you today is that because of who Jesus is, he will never forget you. And what Paul is doing in these verses is he's recapping what Jesus talked about as far as his comeback, or as Christians put it, his second coming. That's why Paul says, according to the Lord's words. All he's saying is, this is what Jesus taught about what was to come after he died and he championed death and he rose from the dead. This is what's coming when Jesus comes back. And every detail, the detail about trumpets and the detail about the loud voice and the detail about graves opening up and dead people coming to life again and people being called into the clouds to be with Jesus, every bit of it points to who Jesus is. It points to how powerful Jesus is, and it points to the fact that if you're a follower of Jesus, you will never be forgotten. It doesn't matter how far gone your situation seems. It doesn't matter how dismal your current circumstances feel. It doesn't matter how deep your flaws are. It doesn't matter how dead things feel around you. If Jesus doesn't forget dead people, he certainly is not going to forget you. And what Paul is showing us here is how powerful a relationship with Jesus is because of how powerful Jesus' authority is. Jesus is powerful enough to command the entire universe. Angels respond. Dead people respond. People who are alive respond. When Jesus speaks at his comeback, it's going to get the attention of the entire universe. He's powerful enough to bring dead people back to life, and no matter how far gone your life feels, if Jesus remembers dead people, he's going to remember you too. Because of who Jesus is, he will never forget you. And this, what this doesn't mean is that what you expect is always going to match what you experience. And I don't know about you, but I feel most forgotten when what I expect doesn't match what I'm experiencing in life. You ever been there? Where you expected something to happen and what you're experiencing is the entire opposite? And what you're navigating there is this gap that we tend to feel when our experience doesn't match our expectation. And here's what I do. I feel that gap with all kinds of stuff. I fill it with disbelief. I fill it with distrust. I fill it with all kinds of things that just spiral me downward because there's this gap between what I experience and what I expect that sometimes I feel with doubt, I fill it with rejection, I fill it with isolation. But here's what I know. Here's what we can learn from this text. The best way to fill that gap between what you expected to happen and what you're experiencing currently is through trust. And I think that trust, if you're looking for a way to relate to God, maybe you don't know how to relate to God, I think this is a practical way for you to relate to God. One of the best ways to relate to God, you know what it is? It's through trust. I believe that through trust, God receives love from people who are trying to follow him. It's one of the ways that he receives love from us. And he doesn't receive it best when we're trusting him when everything's going our way. He receives it best when we're trusting him through the darkness, when we're trusting him through the despair, when we're trusting him when things didn't go the way that we planned, when we're trusting him in the face of a diagnosis that we're not praying for, that we're praying against, when we're trusting him and it doesn't feel like he's showing up in our experience doesn't match what we expected. And there's a story that I want to share with you guys this morning that really points this out. I believe that this is kind of what was going on. And it's found in John chapter 11. And it's about a group of people who Jesus loved. These were his friends. He cared deeply about them. And it's about a man named Lazarus who had gotten sick to the point that his family reached out to Jesus and they sent him a message. And the message was simple. And it was tied to a very simple expectation. Lazarus is sick. They wanted Lazarus better. And they said, Jesus, the one you love, is sick. And when Jesus got the message, here's what he said. Mind you, Jesus wasn't in proximity to them. And so they had to send this message to Jesus. It took some time to get there. And when Jesus got the message, here's what he said. And mind you, the people who sent the message weren't there. He said, "This sickness will not end in death." And then we read, now Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and her sister's name's Mary, and Lazarus. And this is the crazy part for me. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed two more days in the place where he was. He didn't move immediately. The expectation was that Jesus was going to show up and he was going to make everything all right. And he was going to meet us amidst our pain and our struggle and he was going to settle it once and for all. But Jesus stayed in the place where he was for two extra days. And I think one of the keys to this whole scenario is this, that everything Jesus does is motivated by his love for people, but he's only capable of doing what he does because of who he is and the authority that he possesses. So he's motivated by his love for people, but he's capable of doing what he does because of the authority that he possesses. And when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for two more days. And on a surface level, this makes absolutely no sense. And so when he showed up, here's what he showed up to. It's 4 days deep after Lazarus' death. They buried this man 4 days ago. And this was so significant for whoever was there because there was a group of people there that day that believed that within 3 days there was still hope. Within 3 days, God could remember and bring your dead loved one back to life. But this was day four, and on day four is when you were officially forgotten. And so there's this group of people there, friends and family and people who love Lazarus, and they're there to remember Lazarus because according to them, God had forgotten Lazarus. And they're there with Martha and Mary in the middle of their grief. And when Martha heard that Jesus had showed up, here's what she does. She runs to Jesus and she's transparent with Jesus. She tells Jesus how bad it hurts and how painful it is. And here's how I know that's what she's doing. Here's what she says. If you'd been here, Lazarus wouldn't be dead. She's speaking with a level of disappointment in her voice. She's been destroyed by the death of her brother. And she's stuck in this gap between what she expected and what she's currently experiencing. And Jesus responds to her. And he doesn't reject her. He doesn't say, you should have believed or you have to believe or I can't believe you're struggling with despair. I'm here to set the record straight. Here's what Jesus says. He says, your brother will rise again. And then he goes on to say something about who he is that gives him the ability to bring dead people back to life. That gives him the ability to never forget us. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even if he dies, will live. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. And then he says, do you believe this? And here's what Martha says. She says, I believe you are the Messiah. I believe you are who you say you are. I believe you're the Son of God who comes into this world. And tell me you haven't been here. We're in one breath. You're talking about how God forgot you. And you're telling Jesus how bad it hurts. And how you can hardly keep it together. And how you can hardly breathe. And how you can hardly get up in the morning. Because you're in this deep, dark gap between what you expected God to do and what you're experiencing right now. And then in the next breath, you're saying, somehow, God, I know you're here with me through the despair and through the pain and through the disappointment. Somehow, God, I know that you're showing up with me. And then here's what Jesus says. And this is why this is so important for us to know. Here's what we learn about Jesus, because here's what his next move is. He's there amidst the despair and the disappointment. And his next move is he sees broken people, people who have been ravaged by the death of their friend Lazarus. And we read that he was angry in his spirit and deeply moved. And he asked, where have you put him? Where's Lazarus? And then he approaches the tomb and we read that Jesus wept. Jesus is crying. He's ugly crying at the tomb of his friend. And what that means is that he doesn't just remember us in our pain. He shows up in the middle of our pain. He doesn't just acknowledge that life is going to throw things at us that drive us into the valley of grief. He shows up in the valley of grief with us. This is why he's weeping at the tomb of Lazarus. And when people saw him weeping, here's what one group said. They said, oh my gosh, we cannot believe how much he loved him. And then there's this other group of people that are a little skeptical about what's going on, and they're still dealing with their disappointment. And here's what they say. They say, couldn't he who opened the blind man's eyes also have kept this man from dying? Really practical question. Really, really practical question. And I bet you and I have been in seasons where we're asking God practical questions like that. Like, God, why didn't you? Why won't you? When are you going to? But why did Jesus wait? Why did he lay back for 2 days? Why did he wait until Lazarus had been dead for 4 days? If he didn't wait, he wouldn't have been weeping. And if he didn't forget, there wouldn't have been a funeral. And I think Jesus waited because what he's trying to show us is that he's not afraid. He's not afraid of our grief. He's not afraid of our pain. He's not afraid of our fear. He's not afraid of our past. He's not afraid of our insecurity. And when Jesus went to the tomb, here's what he said. He said, remove the stone. And I think in so doing, what he's saying is, let me all the way into your fear. Let me all the way into your insecurity. Let me all the way into your disappointment. Let me into that place that makes you feel most insecure. And here's what Martha says. She's reluctant. She's hesitant. She says, Jesus, he's been dead for 4 days. Can't you smell it? Can't you see that his body's decaying? And what we can see here is that Jesus wants to meet you right in that situation that made you feel forgotten, that made you start to disbelieve, that made you start to doubt. He wants to meet you in that place of your disappointment, that place of rejection, that place of fear, that place of embarrassment or shame or guilt, the place that you've kept closed because you don't really want to let anybody know what's really going on in your life. He wants to come close to what causes you the most fear to show you that he's for you and that he will not forget you. And then here's what Jesus says. He says, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And he shouted with a loud voice. It's my favorite part of the story. Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out of the grave. Look, because of who Jesus is, he will never forget you. Because of who Jesus is, the end of your story isn't the depression. It isn't the character flaw that you've been trying to figure out. The end of your story isn't the rejection. It isn't the isolation. It isn't the anxiety, and it's not the addiction. The end of your story isn't even death. Because of who Jesus is, the end of your story is resurrection. And what Paul Paul is outlining here in these verses is that because of who Jesus is, death can't hold you. What happens to you can't define you, because Jesus has the authority to kill everything that's been trying to kill you. And when he comes back, he's going to shout with a loud voice the same way he shouted to Lazarus. And you're going to hear him shout your name, and the dead in Christ will rise first. And after that, we who are still alive will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And get this. And so we will be with Jesus forever. And what Paul is saying in that last part of verse 17, and so we will be with Jesus forever. What he's saying is, because of who Jesus is, the best is yet to come. Your best days are before you. Your worst days are behind you, because Jesus is for you and he's coming back to get you. And this isn't an empty, it's going to get better and the pain's going to go away and all you need is time and all you need is space and everything's going to feel all right. This isn't the people you're grieving are in a better place. This isn't don't worry about it, keep hoping, because we're all going to be in a better place. Paul isn't talking about us just being in a better place. And frankly, I don't know where you're at, but when I analyze my life, I don't want to just be in a better place. I don't want to be in a better place and be the same me. Frankly, what I don't need is a new scene. What I don't need is a new situation. What I don't necessarily need is a new circumstance. The principal problem in my life has never been where I'm at. It's been who I am. The principal problem in my life has never been that I need to be in a better place. The principal problem in my life is that I need to be remade. I need to be a new me. And frankly, I don't want to just be in a better place for myself. And I want so much more for the people that I care about. I don't want just a better place for the people that I love. I want the people that I love to be made complete. And that's what Paul's getting at. When Paul says we will be with Jesus forever, he's not just talking about us being in Jesus' presence. It's no less than that, but it is so much more than that. We're not just going to be in his presence. What it means is that in Jesus' presence, we will be made complete forever. It means that in his presence, everything that makes us feel incomplete is resolved and rectified and taken care of. It means that our insecurity won't be able to isolate us anymore, and our fears won't be able to find us anymore. It means that what's happened to us won't be able to have a hold on us anymore. It won't be able to define who we are, because in Jesus' presence, we will be made complete forever. Because of who Jesus is, the best is yet to come. And I don't know how you showed up today. I don't know what you're going through. But maybe you're in a season of life where you're allowing what's happening to you to define who you are. And I'm here to tell you that's okay. It's okay. That's exactly where the Thessalonians were. They were in a season of life where they had suffered great loss, and what was happening to them had a hold on them. It was causing them to lose sight of hope, and it was beginning to define who they were. And if you're a Christian and you're honest, I guarantee you you've been in a season through this. I guarantee you that every follower of Jesus has experienced a season of following where they forgot. They forgot about how good God is and how faithful God is and how powerful God is and how hopeful what Jesus has done is. If you're looking for proof of your hope in how you feel or what's happening to you, I need you to hear this, because I think this will unlock something for you. We might sense hope most powerfully when we're on the mountaintops of life, when we're killing it, when we feel like we're making a difference. But our hope is most powerfully demonstrated when we're in the valleys of life and we're believing God through the darkness. We're believing God through the despair. We're believing him even though the prognosis isn't what we prayed for. The situation isn't what we hoped for. Even through the loneliness, even through the addiction, even through the fear, and even in the face of death. I'm going to call the worship team up here right now. We're going to wrap this up. These verses, if you're wondering why they're written, God inspired Paul to write these verses so that people like you and me, people who want to base their hope in what's happening to them, could be set free from being defined by what's happening to us and start living in light of what Jesus has done for us. And all it requires, all this requires is simple. All it requires is that you place your trust in Jesus, that you trust that Jesus championed everything that you can't champion, that Jesus championed even death on your behalf so that you don't have to face death with fear anymore, that Jesus took the weight of your sin and your shame and everything that separated you from the love of God, and he dealt with it fully and wholly and completely when he was stuck on that cross between those two thieves. And if we were to continue reading that story, the way that it plays out is later on that day, Jesus breathes his last breath and the veil that separated the Holy of Holies from people was torn in two from top to bottom. And all that means is that when Jesus died, space was created at God's table for people like you and me, people who were never going to get there otherwise, people who are terrified to die because we don't know what's on the other side. When Jesus died, he dealt with death so that we don't have to. And when Jesus rose, he secured a life that we could only ever imagine. And all it takes is trust. All it takes is trust in the face of fear. And if you're here today and you feel like something's missing, all you have to do is trust Jesus. And we've got people up here that would love to just talk with you about what you're going through and help you process your pain and maybe take a step that could absolutely change your life and release you from defining yourself based on what's happening to you. And you can start defining yourself based on what Jesus has done for you. And if you want to face death the way that the thief faced death, and if you want to face death the way that early Christians faced it, the way that Paul faced it, the way that allowed them to face it without fear, first you have to understand that our hope isn't bound to what happens to us. It's bound to what Jesus has done for us. And secondly, you have to realize that because of who Jesus is, nothing can separate you from the love of God, not even death. Because of who Jesus is, you will never be forgotten. And because of who Jesus is, the best is yet to come. Amen.